This is Spectator Radio, and you're listening to Life in Arts with Dominic Green for Spectator USA.
Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm Life and Arts Editor for Spectator USA, and I'd like to welcome you to our weekly Life and Arts podcast. This week, I'm talking to the Grammy-winning Canadian pianist, entertainer, and composer, Chilly Gonzalez, a phenomenal talent, and in many ways, the heir to the great 19th century tradition of the spectacular, entertaining piano player. Gonzalez is classically trained, but he's well known for recording with artists like Drake, Daft Punk, and Jarvis Cocker. Earlier this year, he launched the Gonservatory, his own music school. He's also got a new album out this year, Solo Piano 3, and is the subject of a cinema release, Shut Up and Play the Piano. So it's a busy year for you, Gonzo. You have a new album out, Solo Piano 3, which is 6 years since the last one. How does this differ?
Well, it's the end of a trilogy, first of all, and it's the rule of threes. I must say doing a Solo Piano 4 just doesn't have quite the same ring to it, but I tend to have the luxury of always surprising people with new projects, new directions. Suddenly chamber music, one album. Suddenly collaboration with Jarvis Cocker called Room 29, or doing an electronic album with Boys Noise. And this is kind of also perhaps some sort of luxury as an artist who always gets to press reset. And you always have the sort of open-ended curiosity of people. And it's just a little bit different when I make a solo piano record, because there are two existing albums which are quite beloved by those who know them. And so for the first time when I did Solo Piano 2, I had to kind of understand I could potentially disappoint people. I could suffer from the comparison to something that exists already. And the number 3 was perhaps even more stressful, because it's the ending and you have to get the ending right. Anyone who writes, comedy, or anyone who does any kind of storytelling or goes on stage to perform, knows you have to get the beginning and the end right. And you can more or less get away with whatever you want in the middle. So that was the extra pressure for closing the trilogy.
You're in a business which would like the ideal artist to have a beginning, middle, and end, which are absolutely identical. And of course, you're crossing genres and doing different things with each project. I don't think listeners have trouble with that, but do you think the music business has trouble understanding that kind of artist?
Not at all, not anymore, because the music business, of course, has splintered and has become more about being more and more like oneself in order to sort of make, I would call them, lifelong fans. The way that I understood to do that was to get in front of them. I'm a performer, and when someone sees a Chilly Gonzalez concert, the various strands of rap, of electronic music, of acoustic music all come together at the piano, and I'm able to render my electronic pieces at the piano. I don't have machines on stage with me. I enjoy the challenge of making something sound modern, up to date. And in a way, it can be almost a hallucinatory experience for the audience to hear me play the piano and feel like they're listening to techno, for example.
Now, I was going to say that's the original musical experience, is to hear a live instrument being played. But of course, for plenty of young people, that isn't the familiar experience. They're used to hearing mechanized music. Do you feel you're taking them back to the origins of music? And does that relate to your understanding of music and the origins of you as a musician?
Well, yes. And as I said, the direction of the industry is actually favoring those who can get back to that. So in a spiritual sense, the Conservatory, which was a mostly self-funded affair wherein I invited 7 musicians from across the world, from all different cultural backgrounds and specifically different musical styles, trying to find those connections, that musical humanism where you focus on what's similar, what's in common rather than the differences. And what I sort of told them was that they're going to get spiritually closer to music because, music was played in caves probably with a musician and some listeners, and was the same for, few thousand years. And then there was this sort of aberration of recording that let people think there was this illusion of a permanent version. And there is no permanent version. And at least in my case, I struggle in this studio when I'm trying to imagine, wow, this is supposed to be the final version of this song. And yet I don't even know who my audience really is. I have to project into the future and into time and space. And it can be quite terrifying. And when I'm in front of people, at least then I can create a unique experience. And the bonus of the way the industry is going is that's the way to also make a living as a musician these days. So I got them in a spiritual sense closer to where I think music was and is. And at the same time, I'm giving them some very pragmatic tools for them to literally pay their bills.
It's interesting when you're talking about this, it reminds me of Jordi Savall and the way in which he has revived in some ways early music and the way that he brings musicians from different disciplines together. And the idea that the true performance of a piece of music is the newest performance or the most recent one, that it is not some fixed thing. The music business and 20th century pop music, as we know it, is of course about fixed recordings. When you're learning, of course, fixed recordings are a major point of reference, aren't they? And what were the recordings which made you realize that the piano, being in many ways the most comprehensive of instruments, might also be the most flexible and the most adaptable in moving, say, between classical and non-classical styles?
Well, perhaps there's something, it's sort of the atomic level of music. If you still consider that music is melody, harmony, and rhythm, the piano is the only instrument capable of delivering that. You can't really go smaller than a piano and still really have all those elements, with maybe the exception of the guitar. But
well, the guitar is a one-handed piano, so you only get halfway there, I feel.
I happen to agree with you as someone who grew up bemoaning the lack of, you know, interesting keyboard pop musicians, of course. Mm-hmm. I always wondered why there was so much focus on the guitar, but, you know.
Well, it's because it's easy. You know, if you're playing simple music, the guitar is a relatively simple instrument to play. It's a very hard one to play halfway well, but it's a very easy one to play in a simple, crude way.
Yes, but when they're rehearsing an opera and they don't have access to the orchestra, they call a pianist, not a guitarist, right, to assume the role of the orchestra. And I would also just say that sheet music was maybe a dry run for recording in a way. And you can see letters from Chopin where he is so frustrated that he's meant to come up with the permanent fixed version of his song. Maybe music publishing was the recording of its day. And there was always this tension between the business end of things, at least since the 1850s, when the Romantic era sort of collided with the beginnings of a music business and cults of personality around people like Paganini and Liszt, and the idea that, oh, there are these personalities now. Music kind of got out of its servile, either religious or royal sort of accompaniment, and became sort of a aspirational cultural middle class activity to observe and be part of. And so the first sort of tension between that art and commerce probably came with music publishing. And, you know, the idea that Chopin, who probably believed, as you said, that the most recent version is therefore the latest version. Yeah, it is frustrating to have to put it on paper or to put it on wax, or in these days to just put it into the computer. And with the conservatory, of course, I want people to understand I'm not saying stop recording. I'm not saying don't take advantage, but it is not a replacement, I think, for music that happens in a room between humans. And it's wonderful you can put your song up on SoundCloud and see those 48 listeners that listen to it within 24 hours. And that's a beautiful thing for a young musician who's also maybe living in a place where they don't have access. There's, you know, there's a lot of countries and continents I just don't visit. You know, I traveled a lot more when I was in my 20s and 30s, and just now it's just not possible. So, you know, there is something beautiful about how technology can almost bridge the gap, but the emphasis is on almost. It can't really bridge the gap. And the greatest skill, if I could pass on to a young musician, would be, here's how you create an authentic moment in front of people. And it involves a strange combination of disciplined preparation, but it also involves then giving over to instinct, giving over to an animal side of yourself, and giving in to that fight or flight instinct, which sort of simulates, I would say, on stage, the feeling of being hunted by a predator. But of course, it's controlled, yes. You know, but the body's reaction is essentially mm-hmm. the same. I'm about to go on stage now in a matter of minutes. And when I get up on that stage, there's going to be this adrenaline and this sort of fight or flight instinct, a fear of humiliation,
yes,
which is essentially a stand-in for the fear of being eaten. And in that moment, I have to give into it. I have to trust that that fear is actually something that's supposed to happen. It will bring out the best in me. The problem comes when musicians try to fight that fear and they close up.
Yes.
You have to open yourself up to the fear of humiliation, and then the audience will love you and embrace you and accept you.
You're reminding me of Stage Fright by the band. There's a song, and there's a band, incidentally, who could actually go with it and improvise and play spontaneously and raise their game live. The limit, it seems to me, of most people working in pop music or rock music, and by contrast, say, to classical music or jazz, is the ability to respond like that, that often people are not technically skillful enough to act spontaneously in that situation. 19th century, and I'm often reminded by the way that the music business has gone recently, that it has brought us back to a similar situation, I think, and not least because the structure of music royalties, right, is still shaped in part by sheet music, which is no longer a major sale. But also, when I was listening to your music, I was reminded more of Liszt and Chopin than I was of, I don't know, Elton John or any of the 20th century pop piano players. Do you feel like an odd man out when you're working with non-classically trained musicians, or is it easy to find a language?
Well, I would say there are certain musical details which I don't really need to share necessarily when I'm working with someone like Daft Punk or Drake, who don't necessarily have the same training I do. I look at the training as something that prepares me for spontaneous moments of performance, hopefully on stage and occasionally in the studio. And I would just say that there's no interplay between the discipline of preparation and the abandonment that you must do when you're in the moment. Mm. It's just one happens literally before the other. One is literally preparing for the other. And so the idea of, well, what's the tension between being an artist and an entertainer? I would just say, I'm an artist when I'm alone, and I'm an entertainer when there's at least one other person in the room. In the case of being in the studio with, let's say, an artist like Daft Punk, they know they need some sort of musical solution. And I've often said I'm almost like a musical plumber in that moment. You know, let me unclog your harmony. And in their case, they literally had a song that was in A minor, and the next song was in B flat minor. And they didn't like how it felt to go from this jarring sort of semitonal shift. And they said, could you do a piano interlude that would give us the feeling that we've arrived smoothly in the new key? So this is not Daft Punk calling and saying, hey, do you want to come help us conceive songs, write lyrics, or, you know, it's a very, very specific slice that they're asking me for. And they just sort of take it for granted in a really positive way that I have those musical tools that I will use. And so it's just up to them to articulate the problem. I don't really need to share the details of the solution with them. My musical knowledge, my training, the side of myself that can be very mathematical or analytical doesn't really need to enter into it in terms of our collaboration. I'm just there to essentially read their body language and try to understand what they want from me. You know, to be a collaborator in my case is usually involves being a kind of fixer. And I'm not the kind of person that often gets called to just do an open-ended collaboration. I don't do a lot of songwriting with people. I'm frankly not that great at it. But if you need me to unclog your harmony, and that's the case with Drake and Daft Punk and other people I've worked with, it's often really in that role. And so everyone has a map of music in their mind. It just so happens mine came from an institutional world where they called it an arpeggio when you play a chord one note at a time.
Or an enharmonic change or something, which is what you were doing there, I believe.
Absolutely. Looking for a chord that is common between A minor and B flat minor, looking for a pivot chord in which I can sort of weave a little bit of a magic trick where by using that chord and sort of shifting what's around it, you have the feeling that you've arrived somewhere new in a very smooth way. And this is not really something that they need to put a name to. I have names for these things because I went to school. They're the names that come from the textbooks that came from my professors. But when I work with an instinctive musician like Peaches, after a couple of days, I realize she does have a map of music in her mind. It's just as valid as mine. It's just that she doesn't have the names for things. It might be a little bit more abstracted in her mind what she's looking for. I think what Daft Punk were trying to tell me was essentially, can you find a pivot chord between these two? But they wouldn't have the nomenclature to be able to really express that. So I just see that that the difference is just that, you know, my knowledge, I have names for things. I'm went to music school and I took what I liked and left behind what I didn't like. And it's essentially what any artist does, whether it's Jarvis, who's mostly a singer, whether it's Daft Punk, who mostly come from a DJ and production world, or with Drake, who's really just essentially a reacting to music that's played to him and writing on top of it, what's called top line writing in the pop world. All of them, they have that map. They've also taken what they liked and left behind what they didn't like. I just have a name for everything. And so I can zoom in a microscopic level that maybe they can't.
You talking of musical maps and the imagination and so on, you hold the Guinness World Record for the longest solo concert at over 27 hours. What went through your mind? I imagine quite a lot, but if you were to pick a certain point in it, what was it like?
Well, I wouldn't nor couldn't perform that performance today. It had to do with ego. It had to do with wanting to, again, press reset on my career and get back to something to prove a point, to find some element of what I'm doing where I look for that sweet spot between poetic transcendence and ridiculousness that I'm always searching for. And it was the thing in the moment that I needed to do. I needed to prove it to myself and I needed to prove it to the world, I suppose. And that just gives you this luxury, you know, that nothing, I mean, we started at midnight, which is actually horrible because usually I'm in bed by 10:30, 11 p.m. Mm. So I would have been I would have had a much better advantage and a head start had I started at 9:30 in the morning when I'm perky and used to start working. I had to start at midnight. I mean, the deck was totally stacked against me. I didn't do any preparation because, of course, there was a lot of promotion around the project. People were interested in it. It was like a superhuman feat to them. And so I ended up actually having a really busy promotion week, which is perhaps the most exhausting thing you can do. And yet, the reason there was no danger of me actually not reaching the 27-hour mark is because I sort of made a deal with myself. My ego made a deal with my body. It was absolutely necessary I get to that 27-hour mark. And so there were some, you know, moments along the way, but I was just, I suppose, in that same animal instinctive fight or flight thing I'm describing, but just stretched out over 27 hours. I mean, talk about adrenaline overload. But not much went through my mind because not much goes through my mind when I'm on stage. I'm trying to be an animal. I mean, you know, in French they call it bête de scène, you know, stage beast. We say a ham, which is essentially a pig. And in German, it's also Rampensau, which is like stage sow. So I think there's a reason that they use this animalistic imagery to describe performance. You're meant to revert to being an animal. And that might seem like a mystical thing that only certain people can do. But with the conservatory, I'm trying to codify that. I'm trying to create exercises, just as maybe Joseph Pilates, who tried to create the sort of physical self-care regimen through very specific exercises. I'm trying to sort of find ways in which the musician can experience it and feel the rush of adrenaline firsthand and understand what that does when you allow yourself to let go in front of the audience.
Yeah.
But that has to be coupled with very intense discipline and preparation. And I often meet musicians who only seem to have one end of it. A lot of classical or jazz musicians, they have the discipline, the preparation, and yet they don't transform into an animal on stage.
Absolutely.
Or you see wonderful, fearless performers, maybe people coming from an art background who are really just not afraid of anything on stage, and yet they're missing that discipline so that the music itself isn't quite ready to survive that translation to the animal instinct. Conservatory was meant to try to fuse those in people, those two sides.
I wondered if this is connected in a way to the loss of the improvising ability among classical musicians, because it's well known that until fairly recently, a decent classical musician was able to improvise. And now you hardly ever meet one who can string a couple of phrases together. Then again, if you look at the earlier history of jazz, They were not always people who were technically accomplished at all, but were very good ear musicians and were therefore able to respond on their feet in that way you're describing, to play, you know, intuitively and so on. Both fields seem to be out of balance in a way. Do you see that as a spiritual problem or a technical challenge or a bit of both?
I just believe that we lost the composer-performer. The composer-performer meant that you had to improvise. Mm-hmm. Now composers, composition, and performance have become very separated in this classical world, especially. Very few pianists, I mean, I can only think of a handful right now, who have that sort of Leonard Bernstein multiple, triple threat, let's call it, conducting, composing, performing. Mm-hmm. In the case of Bernstein, also educating. I mean, he's a great role model for that, or a Quincy Jones figure. They're very rare. And I believe if the composer-performer fusion could happen more often, then it would all come back. And I guess the point is that when classical music became a sort of self-imposed museum of itself, I believe that people who loved being on stage, the bêtes de scène, the hams, the rampenzows, we all went somewhere else because we felt like, well, we're not really welcome here in the end. And I think I could have enjoyed being a composer performer in the classical mold, but very early on I sensed that, well, this world, it's not really for me. Where are the composer performers now? Well, they're singer-songwriters, or they're rappers, or they're electronic musicians, and they go on stage and they perform their own music. So, and most of them know how to improvise. Most of them, especially if they're solo performers or duo performers who know each other really well, you get the shorthand and you're really able to take it somewhere new every time you play, obviously. Yes, that's been lost. And now we're in a museum where you're not even allowed to clap for your favorite movement. And you know, I know many classical institutions are trying to make an effort. You know, they hire a VJ, or maybe they're going to hire an actor to dress up in a wig and pretend to be Beethoven and explain why he wrote a certain piece. And I think that's all well and good. You know, like sometimes you'll see some classical hall be like, you know, we have an Instagram now. Yeah. And it's like, okay, you know, I appreciate the effort, but I think the problem is deeper than that. The problem is the self-imposed museum mentality.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are wonderful composer performers. You know, there's a little swelling movement of, not all of them piano-based either, but quite a few based on the piano. There's a little movement in Germany they call the neoclassical movement. And those moments are welcome because at least you have the return of composer performers. And when I did my first solo piano record in 2004, there weren't so many of us. Especially those who came from electronic underground or sort of pop worlds. And I'm just so glad there's more of us now and more of us have the chance to play in concert halls. I mean, I played in Cadogan Hall last night in London and turned it into the Chili Gonzalez surreal living room. And part of that is just my bathrobe and slippers, but part of that is just because I truly prioritize what the audience is feeling. I'm an attentive musician, and perhaps that's what's missing. I think classical and jazz musicians are very attentive to the music, and that's wonderful. That's the prerequisite. That's the baseline. But if you don't go that extra step and be attentive to the audience, then you've really, I think you just missed an opportunity to create something beautiful. And I had them on their feet. They were just going nuts. And that's because I was attentive to the music as I prepared. But when I got on stage, I kind of forgot about all that, trusted my muscle memory, trusted my instincts. And I was suddenly more attentive to the audience, much more attentive to the audience than I am of my own pieces in that moment.
Well, I know that now you're about to go on stage, and I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us. And I think what you're saying is very important. In many ways, I think of you as being the heir to the Romantic piano, far more than many conservatory-trained musicians who might have stuck with it. And as you're saying, this is also the spirit of rock and roll that you're playing in. And these two things are not so far apart. So thank you for taking the time to talk about it. And good luck with the conservatory, too.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're going to do it every year. So stay tuned for the 2019 announcement for applications. We're hoping to get more musical humanism going, and that means people from far-flung parts of the world, and all expenses paid. We bring them to come hang out for a week and talk about audience psychology, talk about how to let out the beast within.